Okay. I'm calling the House Transportation Committee to order today. This is March 10th, 2011, and it is 1:33. And let the record show that Representative Johnson, Representative Feige, I saw Representative Pruitt just a second ago.
He's slippery.
Representative Peterson and myself, Wilson, are here, and I know I saw him. Well, anyway, we'll announce him when he comes in, I guess. We're going to get started. I would like to recognize the staff today. Nancy Hemingway is in the against the wall over there. She's our House Recording Secretary. Ryan is our LIO monitor. Becky Rooney is my chief of staff. And before we start, please turn off your cell phones. And today we will be hearing two bills, House Bill 57, Bicycle Program, from Rep. Seaton, and also from, I have House Bill 158, the Kinnick Arm Bridge Toll Authority, and Representative Pruitt has just joined us. And I don't intend to move either bill today. However, we will get started right away, and Rep. Seaton, and I think Mary, are you going to present the bill? Okay. Come forward and state your name and affiliation for the record, and would someone please move the CS version B before us?
Yeah. Let's see. I'm sure I get the right information on it. All right. I move CS for House Bill 5727-1 LS0315B.
All right. We have version B before us, and Representative Seaton, would you kind of explain to us the changes that you've made and go over the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. Yes. House Bill 57, the CS that you have before us, on page 2, lines 1 and 2, inserts educate the public on the safe use of bicycles and traffic laws relating to bicycles and motor vehicles. And this was in response to questions from the committee about education and making sure that that was, although it was safe bike bill, and make sure that that was a prominent feature and that there was no question that people could apply for grants for educating bicyclists and motor vehicle about the traffic laws and those things so that we have safe use of bikes. Page 2, line 7, it inserts to establish safety and education programs described in A2 of this section, which is what we've just been talking about. And then on page 2, lines 19 and 20, again, we're inserting educating the public on the safe use of bicycles, traffic laws relating to bicycles and motor vehicles. And then the other only other change is what we talked about before, was changing the year from 2011 to 2012 on page 3, line 4, and then and the date on page 3, line 8, from 2012 to 2014.
Did you say line 4? Did you mean line 14?
Better check the script here. It is... Yes. Okay. Sorry, Madam Chair, it was line 14.
Okay.
And line and the other is line 18.
Okay. Yeah, 14 and 18. All right. All right. Are there any questions from the committee members? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Seaton, we talk about educating the public. I've already seen ads on TV, you know, promoting what the laws for bicycle use are and when they're trying to navigate among traffic. And I'm wondering, is this going to be additional public service announcements, or is it just going to be, you know, promoted differently, or what are the changes in that, if there are?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson. Yes, this is just clarifying that when those programs, municipalities want to promote safe use of bikes, that they can specifically do bicycle education programs. Not all communities around the state have TV as their, you know, local TV as their most available and reasonable way to educate people. It may be flyers, it may be, you know, whatever that locality decides. I'm sure a village is going to, that's, you know, is going to have a different safe bicycle use program than downtown Anchorage or Fairbanks.
And let the record show that Representative Munoz has joined us. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. On House Bill 57, I'm curious if you've gotten feedback from small business bike shop owners. And I bring that to your attention because I have been getting feedback, and I'm concerned about the potential competition with the businesses and local government.
Representative Munoz, through the chair. We did receive feedback and distributed to the committee here from one Mr. Peter Roberts, owner of Downtown Bike Rental in Anchorage. We've had feedback from other bicycle shops in my area that are supportive of the bill because they know as the public becomes much more using bicycles, they will tend to upgrade to better bikes. They will have their own so that they're, you know, depending upon what the program is that's been applied for. So it's a mixed bag. There are some people that have a tourist business, basically, that think that, you know, a certain kind of program, if a community sponsored that, could impact them. However, there are numerous ways in which people could be building bike racks, bike facilities, so that bicycles could be safely stored, which would enhance bicycle ownership and bicycle, you know, bicycle repairs and upgrades and those kind of things. And one of the things that we're trying to promote with this bill, of course, is the bicycle trailers as well, because you can't expect someone, a resident, to go to the grocery store and be balancing bag of groceries. That wouldn't be a safe use of bicycles. So there are now new kinds of equipment that can go with bicycles that are much safer and make it a mode of transportation. And that's what we're trying to promote here. We're not trying to get into the visitor industry. I don't think that a municipality would try to do a program that was in competition with somebody else that was providing that service. The problem is we have all across the state numerous communities that do not have the services of bicycle shops or do not have the bicycles of the kind that would be used for transportation and as a mode of transportation. You know, the recreational bicycles, I would not anticipate that communities would go forward or nonprofits or anybody that's trying to promote alternative transportation for people, that they would be, you know, looking at these very expensive bicycles, which are what generally, after people are using bikes a lot, they tend to like better and better bicycles. So, and that's, you know, that's the kind of response that we've gotten. It's mixed.
Okay. Any other comments? All right. I would like to, is there anyone from the departments at all that would like to testify? Any of our DOT or anything like that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Jeff Otteson, Director of Program Development at the Department of Transportation. I think last time we were here, we gave testimony about the importance of bicycling to Alaska. We're one of the leaders among states in terms of our citizens' use of bicycles for commuting, for example. And I think our only suggestion to the bill was to clarify that education was permissible. And that's been done, so I really have nothing else to add.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? All right, then we will go to public testimony. And in Homer, well, they have a cycling club down there.
Yeah.
Derek Reynolds, are you online?
And I am here.
Okay, go ahead, Derek. State your name and affiliation.
My name is Derek Reynolds. I do live in Homer, where I own and operate Psychological, a small bicycle repair and retail shop. And I fully support and thank Representatives Seaton and Grunberg and their staff for their efforts on this bill. And thank you all on the committee for considering it as well. Being in the bicycle business, I feel I'm in a pretty fair position to know, understand, and appreciate the cycling community in Homer. I've witnessed over the past 5 years a growing number of cyclists coming through my doors and passing me on the roads and bike paths, from toddlers just scooting their way to balance on two wheels to the dedicated commuter who's pretty much prepared to do whatever the elements decide and ride in it regardless. It's a pretty incredible cross-section of the population here, and I get to meet and greet and talk bikes with each of them. A lot to talk about. What I hear most concerns the lack of safe roads, such that many a would-be it's my first time, so I'm not used to the speaker system. Anyway, where was I? Yeah. I get to meet a lot of the population and talk bikes with them. A lot to talk about. And mostly here, the safe roads is their biggest deterrent to biking. It makes many a would-be commuter too fearful to ride for the lack of safe roads and ride anywhere but on a separated bike path in and or around town where bike routes do exist. I can empathize with them. We as cyclists are pretty exposed out there. Simple solution? Outlaw cars altogether. Totally unreasonable, I know. So we got to explore other options. Quickest route to reducing the number of cars and trucks on the road so that people feel safer on bikes is pretty simple, by getting more people to ride bikes. House Bill 57 does speak to this. While it won't create a bike path on every road, it could help fund a community bike garage for people to park their bikes or check one out if they don't have one. They could also check out a grant-funded trailer, a grant-funded lock, ride through town following grant-funded signage, park their bike at grant-funded bike racks, do their shopping, and return their bike and trailer to the garage. Similar bike share programs exist all over the country and have had considerable success in promoting bikes as transportation for locals and tourists alike. As a business owner, I don't really feel threatened by this bill. As Representative Seaton pointed out, I feel like more people riding bikes is the key and will actually help grow my business more than anything. I can understand the rental aspect of it, where they might feel some competition threat there, except that most people who are in the market to rent a bike, they're going to rent a bike because they want a reliable quality machine, whereas in a bike share program, you might not be getting the state-of-the-art road bike that you want to ride. That's my stance as the business end of it. In the community end of it, I also sort of represent the Homer Cycling Club as well, and we have several other organizations already sort of actively pursuing to improve conditions for cyclists in Homer, and all of them have materially shown a commitment to cycling. It's a growing trend, and I really think that this is an important bill to pass, and I thank you for considering it.
Okay, and Derek, I have a question for you, and that is, have you, because essentially you're saying that you want the state of Alaska to fund some of this so that organizations can sponsor a program. Have you gone to your city council and to ask for anything like that? For your town?
I have not myself.
Okay.
Short answer, I guess, would be no. I have not.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Any questions? Seeing none, we'll go to Chase Warren.
For the record, Chase Warren. I'm here representing the Homer Cycling Club. I also have worked for Psychological, one of two local bike shops for almost 2 years now, and have commuted mainly by bike in the Homer area for all 5 years. I fully support this bill as well, and feel that most importantly for the Homer area, that this bill could significantly increase the safety of everybody on our roads and not just cyclists. I guess that's just my short show of support. That's all.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chase. Catriona Lowe?
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Catriona Lowe, and I'm a resident of Homer and a longtime cyclist. I'm also a member of Homer Cycling Club, and we're a nonprofit group which formed in 2010 to improve conditions for bicyclists at the local level and to establish bike routes and mountain bike trails, host group rides, and organize events like races and promote bicycling as an environmentally friendly, healthy, and enjoyable way to go. I believe House Bill 57 holds great potential for Alaskans. Using non-motorized transportation such as bicycles impacts life in so many beneficial ways that even relatively small amounts of dollars invested will have large positive impact. One of the things I like most about this bill is that it allows each community to develop programs that best meet the local needs. For example, one of the biggest barriers to safe cycling in the Homer area is the lack of education about the basic rules of the road. The need for education applies to both drivers of motor vehicles and the people on bikes. A way to fund classes and workshops or other methods of informing road users of the do's and don'ts would be very worthwhile. On a personal level, I attempt to use my bike for as many journeys as possible. You might think that Alaskan conditions are not conducive to year-round commuting by bike, and I'm finding that otherwise. So far, I've biked to work a little over 60% of the days in 2011. And I've driven my car a total of 670 miles in the year so far. And I've greatly reduced my own personal gas costs while reducing wear and tear on the roads and as well as on my vehicle. I have children in the 4th and 8th grade, and I encourage them to use their bikes as much as possible. This means independent transportation and gives them a chance to make extra trips to the library and the beach, as well as giving them a fun means to get exercise on their way to school. They're in a minority, though, and many of the parents feel there's no safe place to ride, and they're unaware of how to empower their children to travel safely by bike. You may wonder why I'm advocating for the state of Alaska to help fund support for non-motorized transportation. I think state government plays an essential central role in creating and maintaining seamless, safe transportation infrastructure. Bike resources and facilities of all kinds are a key part of this. I couldn't really find Alaskan statistics, but biking or walking currently total 12% of the trips that Americans make, but only cost 1.5% of the transportation spending. And that's the type of cost effectiveness that budgets need right now. Bikes keep us healthy. They get us from point A to point B. They save us from high gas prices, and they make our air cleaner and our roads less congested. Bikes great for health, good for communities, and a solution to many of our most pressing societal and environmental problems. Cost-effective investments in bicycling will boost the economy, help individuals and the state of Alaska save money, and directly address key societal challenges such as obesity and road congestion. And they can benefit individuals, the whole community, and the whole state, and I guess eventually the nation. So in these tough economic times, our state government can only afford to invest in solutions that solve multiple problems, and I think bicycling fits the bill. Thank you.
Kate, thank you very much. Let's go to Michael Neese.
Yes, thank you. This is Michael Neese. Boy, that's a hard act to follow. I don't know. I'll have to say I support her position and House Bill 57. That's great. She hit a lot of the points there. I basically represent on the board or the commission for the Economic Development Commission for the City of Homer and also the Homer Grange and other organizations that all support the use of bicycles, the use of public transportation, et cetera. So I'm not going to go on. I think it's been stated right there very well, very succinctly. But I do want to point out one thing to during the winters, I ride all the time. I do not own a car. The shoulders, a little more effort towards the shoulders of the road would be great during the winter. So hopefully this total, informational idea here to to get people more aware of bicycling and the challenges and whatnot. Or, you know, it's all part and parcel of a broader program. So I support Senate or House Bill 57. Thank you very much.
Michael, do you have bike paths in Homer?
Think about that for a second. We actually have one, and we've been talking about it for years. I was on the Global Warming Task Force in 2006 and 7, and we talked about more, you know, trying to develop that through the parks, different things. The only one that I can honestly say that we have is on East End Road. I live on Ketchmack Drive, and there's not one, and it's a very treacherous you know, commute every day. So to answer your question, we do have one short one. I think it's, 2 miles long? Is that right?
Maybe a little bit.
Maybe a little longer than that. But, you know, it's a start, and we're looking towards developing more.
Okay, thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michael, I was wondering, you say you ride year-round. Do you have studs for your bike tires in the wintertime?
I guess I'm just a hardhead. You know, I'm almost 60, so not that that's an excuse or a reason, but no, I don't. You know, I think sometimes it develops a sense of false security, and so, you know, I either walk or I ride during conditions, and, you know, I pay attention to the drivers and whatnot. So, but no, I do not have studs on my bike, never have, and I've been riding bike, you know, here and everywhere else for most of my life. So,
thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify? Oh, yes, we have, I'm sorry, I do have one more person, Peter Roberts in Anchorage. And I do believe that in our packet we have a letter that Peter sent us. So, Peter, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I hope that everyone on the committee has had a chance to read the reasons why I oppose this bill. Listening to the testimony so far, I can say that there's a lot of assumptions out there. Even Representative Seaton has acknowledged that there's the chance for some sort of competition out there. But I'd like him to answer, and some of the other people that have testified, how much competition and how much business should we lose before if someone decides that we've lost too much? One of the people in Homer, you know, they implied that it would be better to have the government run the bike share program because the bikes that a bike rental business would provide would be better. He seemed to me to be implying that the bikes provided by the government would almost be unsafe. Now, does this program anticipate insurance and liability issues if someone is injured on one of these government-sponsored bicycles? It just seems to be a lot of questions, and it doesn't seem to be thought through. In fact, as you know from reading my testimony, the same bill came up 2 years ago, and Representative Gruenberg and Seaton knew that I was against it, and I only found out about this bill the day before yesterday. And it seems to me that this bill, you should vote no on it. They should send it back to the drawing board, and they should consult with affected constituents before they introduce legislation like this. There is a lot wrong with this bill. I will wave the flag for bicycling higher than anybody that has testified so far. I rode my bike to this hearing, and there's no dispute about how great bikes are. The issue is whether or not the government should be spending money on things that you and I know are good, but trying to get to change people's behavior is a very difficult thing. The education aspect of the bill, fine. But you got to take out this part about giving free maintenance and free bikes and helmets and trailers to people. The gentleman, Homer, he seems to think that it would be better if the government provided the trailers. Well, if he thinks that, why doesn't he fill that niche himself? I mean, that's the American way. I'll bet you anything, you know, that he would do a better job. There would be better availability of the trailers. And maybe if he's lucky, he'd earn a profit and pay some taxes, And that would help the economy. Instead of asking the government and taking money from businesses that are making a profit and using it to give away what we could charge for and increase competition. That's the way it should be done. But, you know, once again, I think the committee needs to, you know, vote no and send this back to the drawing board. And if you support bicycling, fund infrastructure, fund bike racks, fund trails. Make it more appealing for people that want to commute to commute. And if there are people that are on the fence about commuting, well, get them to fall on the side of the fence of commuting by increasing the safety of our trails and making more and better bike routes.
Okay, thank you very much, Peter. And Representative Feige has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Roberts, what do you feel are the main impediments to more people using bikes in Alaska?
It's not just what I think. I attended a conference a couple of years ago here in Anchorage at the Hilton Hotel, and they had experts come in from around the country. And it's infrastructure. The impediment is, and that's something that was in my written testimony too, is people need to know that if they're going to do this, if they're going to commute, that they need to have the right routes. Now, if the problem is the bicycle itself or they can't afford a bicycle, I proposed an alternative, and that would be the Bucks for Bikes voucher, and give people that can't afford a bicycle a coupon or a voucher so that they can patronize an existing business and make it more likely for them to afford a bicycle. So the answer to your question is, one, infrastructure. I can't emphasize that enough. Infrastructure, infrastructure. And it's not just me that says that. And then the second way would be to try the program like Cash for Clunkers or Bikes for Bucks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Roberts, and good luck with your business.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, we will go now to... I guess what I'll do probably is just go ahead and leave testimony open for the next time that we hear this bill, and then Representative Seaton, did you want to have any last comments at all before we?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
All right. Okay, I'm going to leave it open, and the next time we have it, we'll hear this bill. We'll, if there's anybody else that still wants to testify, we can hear them. Okay, let's go on then and to our next bill, and our next bill is House Bill 158, the Kinnick Arm Bridge Toll Authority, are known to a lot of us as KABATA, and Rep. Newman, would you come forward and introduce yourself and your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Transportation Committee, Representative Mark Newman from the beautiful Susitna River Valley. And, Madam Chair, I have to say it's a pleasure to come back to the Transportation Committee where I was able to serve, I think, with you and Representative Johnson a few years ago, and brings back good memories. Madam Chair, House Bill 158 will help ensure a successful public-private partnership procurement for the process for the Kinnick Arm Crossing and generate the best value for the state of Alaska. This legislation will reduce the cost of financing, the project and facilities, and opening for traffic in 2015, expediting the benefits of the Kinnick Arm Crossing. And, Madam Chair, in your packets, it's a pretty extensive packet. It talks about the Matsu Borough as being the fastest-growing area of the state, 31st in the nation. We're up to about over 88,000 people and growing. We have some new and existing roads coming on. The bridge is an additional route to Anchorage with the largest population, just under 300,000. But some of the existing problems we've got is the congestion in the roads, and I'll cover a little bit of that when I talk about the safety of these projects. Economic values, obviously the creating of jobs, the growth, construction, and diversifying our economy and transportation routes. And, Madam Chair, something that's somewhat difficult for me to even talk about anymore is the fact of the safety that we've got in Alaska. We've got the Glen Parks Highway. And, Madam Chair, thank you again publicly for bringing the Transportation Committee out to the Valley last year and spending time actually touring our roads and seeing what was going on there. But until you get in the middle of traffic congestion and about 7 o'clock in the morning, 6 in the morning, and it's bumper to bumper and it's snowy and it's dark, and your life is hanging on here by your fingernails. It's a white knuckle ride. And we're going through there. This last year, we just kind of finished up some of the rut rehabilitation programs on the Glen Highway, and this $50 to $70 million that goes into this rut rehabilitation. This road's 250% over carrying capacity. 250%. So we can continue to spend tremendous amounts of money or try and find different roads and expand our existing system that we've got. And, Madam Chair, I just lost three of my constituents here recently on Connect Road. The congestion on our highways is terrible. These roads, this bridge connects to the Parks Highway and Connect Goose Bay and even the Seward Highway to the three highway safety traffic zones that we've got, the three deadliest roads in the state. We have to expand our transportation system into new areas of the state that does help create economic growth into some of these areas. It's absolutely critical. And included in your packet is some of the death and accident rates. 38 fatalities. 38 of my constituents were lost in Connect Goose Bay Road since 77 through 10. 93 major accidents where people were maimed and injured. On the Parks Highway, you know, Wasilla to Big Lake, on about a 9-mile stretch, 16 fatalities, 51 major accidents. And it's critical that we kind of expand these areas. And a lot of that's in your support information, and I'll try and briefly touch on some of that. And we also look at safety, too. When you're going out to the Valley and we want to expand pipelines, we want to expand mines, we're connected to Anchorage, which is our largest container port, the largest port in Alaska. To get all that merchandise, that freight, comes across the Eagle River Bridge. Old bridge, old highway, done in the 70s, late 60s. If we had a major earthquake that took that bridge out, it would literally cut off everything north of Anchorage. Cripple Bay, Matsu, those areas. How do you move that freight? Having another alternate route with a new modern bridge that's rated to withstand better than 8 earthquakes is critical to moving that transportation and the security for our state, including our military bases, that depend on the movement of the people of this, the jobs that are created in Anchorage. In the Matsu, in my area, it's interesting. We have, I believe, the numbers are about 30,000 people a day have to go to Anchorage for work. Having another route to do that, to get around this congestion, and as somebody who's lived there for better than 30 years now, trying to get through Wasilla, and some of you have seen that, you've been through those areas, new traffic routes have to start being developed, or we can continue to put money into trying to deal with what we got again with the Parks and Glen, which literally can't be expanded anymore. There's not a whole lot of choices besides to create new road projects to continue our economic development in the state of Alaska, and this is what this bridge proposes to do. The Connect Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created in 2003, and it's been through extensive environmental decisions, a lot of project decisions that have done from the federal government, the state government through the DOT, Revenue, Attorney General's office, or through the legislature. Just about every part of government's gone through there. And on December 15th of 2010, after many years of hard work by Kubota and DOT, the Federal Highway Administration signed a record of decision for the Connect Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. That's a milestone, Madam Chair and members. It provides the environmental clearances necessary for crossing and to move this project forward and become a reality. and realizing what they had to go through with all the environmental regulations, particularly with the listing of the beluga whales and such, and as a specific species within Kinnick Arm Bridge, I think it demonstrates the amount of scrutiny that this project has been under. You know, they would not receive that record of decision if they did not feel that this was a project that was absolutely necessary and can be done safely. It was interesting, too, then I'm going to point out just briefly on some of the numbers, the cost of this bridge that was coming through in 09, I believe, was the date, where they, Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority had expected value or cost of this of about $687 million. DOT wanted an independent analysis of that. They came in with that independent analysis, it was about $682 million. Now, a $700 million project, and you can come in with within $5 million, I think that shows to the professionalism that's been done by the group at Kubota, you know, with the numbers that they're trying to bring forward. And it's a clear indication that the work that they've done is good, and again, backed up and approved through the federal government. We have letters of support by the Alaska Trucking Association in your group, the Alaska Support Industry, our oil and gas industry, the Mat-Su Borough, City of Wasilla, Municipality of Anchorage, and various trade groups, you know, who would like to see this bridge happen. We had some Dittman polls that have done to see what the public feels about this bridge. It runs about average of 60% statewide in approval for the moving ahead on this bridge. Obviously, it's much higher than that for the people who have to try and drive these roads every day and realize that. And, Madam Chair, it's critical that we move this legislation for this public-private partnership ahead this year, and I know that you're very familiar that how those projects seem to be moving. Because the cost of road projects are continuing to increase so high, public-private partnerships are increasing when it comes to road projects. Now, the state will run this, own this, and operate it, but it will partner. And we have folks from Kubota that can get further into depth into that to make sure that I don't screw up and say something wrong on the technical information there. But as a general sense there, I want to make sure that you're aware of that. And as very briefly, the summary of this legislation is also included in there. Simply said, you know, it says in the first paragraph, an investment in Alaska's future, and adding to the successful procurement of this, and they've went through the property tax clarifications, contractual, creating this project reserve fund. Again, just briefly hitting some of the analysis of the legislation is the extension of this and to stimulate and advance the economic welfare of the state. And then again, I point to the record of decision on that. And Madam Chair, I could probably go on for quite a while about the benefits of this. I have sat on the board of Kubota for going on 4 years now as a non-voting member of the legislature, because we are an appropriations body. It's not appropriate to have a voting member. But I've sat on there and through many, many meetings of this, through a tremendous amount of scrutiny from many organizations. And they continue to move forward on this. And it's amazing the amount of professionalism and quality work that's gone into this project. And with that, Madam Chair, I can answer some 10,000-foot view questions. I'm very familiar with the project. But we do have Jeff Otteson here from DOT, now a member of the board, so very familiar with this project. Andrew Nemec and the project managers, folks from Kubota here, Kevin Hemingway. If you'd like to also bring those forward, and they can answer maybe some of the technical questions for the committee.
Okay, well, seeing no questions, let's go ahead and do that. Can someone from Kubota come forward?
I'll just move over here, Madam Chair.
That's fine. State your name and affiliation, and then each time you switch people speaking, if you'd say your name again so that the person back there transcribing will know who's speaking.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Andrew Nemec. I'm the executive director for the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority, and I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee and your consideration of the legislation before you. The authority is committed to advancing the Kinnick Arm Crossing project, which will provide sustainable jobs and economic opportunities for generations of Alaskans. And our purpose is to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems in the vicinity of Upper Cook Inlet by constructing a bridge between the municipality of Anchorage and the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. And as confirmed in the environmental impact statement, the crossing is an essential project providing improved regional transportation, infrastructure, national highway system connectivity for the movement of people and goods from South Central to the interior and the North Slope of Alaska. And it provides safety and an alternate route between Alaska's most populated areas and also for disaster relief and emergency response. As mentioned by Representative Newman, the Kinnick Arm Crossing is being developed as a federal aid highway project. The FHWA is the lead federal agency and has issued a build recommendation, a build record of decision. That was done on December 15th of last year. We are currently continuing with environmental permitting and right-of-way acquisition. Those activities are ongoing. The project itself, the first phase, is estimated to cost $716 million. It's for construction of a minimum 8,200-foot toll bridge, 18 miles of approach roads, and an 800-foot cut-and-cover tunnel through Government Hill. And the project will be delivered under what's called a public-private partnership. It's often referred to as a PPP or also a P3 agreement. The main statutory changes to AS 1975 is outlined in House Bill 158, four main areas: increase Kubota's bonding authority, clarify property tax language, address contractual monetary obligations, and add language to establish and manage a reserve fund. The increase in bonding authority from $500 million to $600 million matches the $600 million allocation of private activity bonds. It's a capacity issued or provided by USDOT for the purpose of the project and to Kubota. And it's important to note that any private activity bonds issued are the liability of the borrower, the private borrower, not the state of Alaska. The property tax language clarifies that the bridge and specifies that the bridge and the associated connections are not subject to property tax if operated by a private developer on behalf of the state. And that would be similar to any other state facility if it was operated by the state of Alaska. AS 1975 is modified to clarify that monetary obligations under a public-private partnership for the purposes of constructing the facility are obligations of the state, and satisfaction of those obligations from other than Kubota funds are subject to appropriation. And I repeat, the change applies only to liabilities, monetary liabilities associated with the public-private partnership. There's other or could be other liabilities of Kubota, and those obligations remain separate from the state. And prior to a public-private agreement being approved, there's a comprehensive evaluation process that involves the Department of Transportation, the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Law. And the change is necessary and essential to attract low-cost debt and equity to finance the project. It will reduce the availability payments that Kubota and the state have to make to the private developer, and it will help keep tolls affordable for the traveling public. The project reserve fund provisions are added to allow Kubota to properly manage project toll revenues and our contractual obligations under the agreement. The reserve fund will apply sources of revenue, both tolls and any appropriated funds, for specific purposes such as compensation to the private partner. Surplus funds are then available for capacity improvements and other federally eligible transportation projects. The statutory language provides that any appropriations that were to be made are held separately by the Department of Revenue until a public-private partnership is in place, and at which time they would be deposited into this reserve. And we do have advisors under contract with the Department of Law. They have reviewed this legislation. I'll wrap up just by saying there continues to be very strong public support for the project. In a January statewide survey, 60% of Alaskans, and that's statewide, say now is the time to build the bridge. And 75% of Alaskans believe the bridge will lead to more jobs and economic growth. Thank you.
Through Madam Chair, my name is Kevin Hemenway. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority, or KIBOTA. I came to KIBOTA after a 25-year career in the private sector in finance and accounting, and I've been the CFO of two publicly traded companies and have been involved in the successful completion of well over $2 billion of financing transactions during my career. This was my first public sector job, and I was attracted to the Kinnick Arm Crossing project because it's different than other transportation infrastructure projects in the state. First, it's a toll bridge that will generate revenue. There's almost no other project in the state that generates revenue, and if they do, they tend not to generate revenue that's sufficient to cover their cost. Second, it will be the first new major highway since the parks and constructing the Hall Road up to Prudhoe Bay in the 70s. So it's been 30 years since we've done a signature transportation project in the state. Finally, it's going to be delivered as under a public-private partnership, which transfers substantial project risk to the private sector and manages the full life cycle cost of the project. So all of the costs of operations and maintenance are recognized, acknowledged, and built into the partnership plan up front, which is quite a bit different than most other transportation projects in the state. Andrew mentioned a significant milestone was reached in December when the Federal Highway Administration, after about 7 years of study this time around, finally issued a record of decision that's a build for the project that permits us to move forward into the marketplace and get procurement for a private partner, get to construction, and the bridge could be open to the public as early as 2015 or 2016 on a 3 to 4 year construction cycle. I want to explain a little bit about the public-private partnership structure. I'm going to refer to it as P3 from here on just because it's faster. Under the public-private partnership, or P3, the private sector will design, build, finance, operate, and maintain the facility for a period of 35 to 40 years under strict contractual terms in exchange for periodic payments, most likely annually. They'll raise debt and equity and borrow debt to finance the project, not the state or KIBOTA. The periodic payments will be used by the private partner to pay for the operations and maintenance of the bridge and connecting roads and to repay the project financing. And at the end of the term, the facilities will be handed back to state control in a near new state as required by the contract. The state, through KIBOTA, will own the bridge facilities at all times over the life of the structure, not the private partner. The state will set tolls and own the toll revenue stream. The toll revenue will be used to make the periodic payments to the private partner. And any surplus, as the project develops traffic and generates more than is required for the annual payments, will be used to fund project improvements and other transportation infrastructure around the state. Competition for the project, from the private sector perspective, will be providing the state the lowest annual payment offer. The proposals from prospective partners will be evaluated by a committee under a rigorous criteria evaluation. Andrew already mentioned that it includes the Department of Transportation and Revenue, Attorney General, members of KIBOTA, and industry experts. But final approval will be by the KIBOTA Board of Directors, comprised of one member each from the House and Senate, the Commissioners of Revenue and Transportation, and three members from the public appointed by the Governor. Andrew already mentioned that financing cost is the most significant component the private sector will have to consider in proposing what the annual payment offer will be to the state for finance, design, build, operate, and maintenance of the structure. Lowering the cost of financing for the private partner results in best value for the state because they'll be able to sharpen their pencil and give us lower proposals. HB 158 is important to achieving that best value because it will reduce the cost of financing for the private partner and provide the mechanisms required and expected by the private marketplace to establish a contractual structure that's workable from their view. We're working to lower the cost of capital for our private partner in other ways as well. We have recently submitted to a U.S. DOT program called TIFIA, Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, It is a low-cost loan program for federal projects. This is a federal project. The FHWA has been involved from the beginning. And that will allow our prospective private partners to borrow that low-cost capital and sharpen their pencils again for their proposals. Andrew also mentioned that we've been allocated $600 million of private activity bond capacity by USDOT. That allows our private partners to borrow money on a tax-exempt basis, and that equates to lower interest rates and more refined proposals. That is one of the items in HB 158, is to increase the issuance capacity of the authority, because private activity bonds require a public issuer, but the public is not the borrower of that debt. And I want to remind the committee that the private partner, not the state or Kubota, will be the borrower of any project financing under the public-private partnership structure we're proposing. Some have questioned whether traffic will be sufficient to pay for will generate sufficient tolls to pay for the annual availability payment. We recognized early on that this is really a financing project in terms of delivery beyond the infrastructure needs of the public. And we hired Wilbur Smith Associates. They are the preeminent traffic and toll revenue forecasters in the nation as the project's traffic and toll revenue consulting engineer. Their studies are investment grade. That means that you can take them to Wall Street and issue bonds on them. So their dependability is high. And their track record for forecasting is exceptional within the industry. They are the preeminent firm. Their studies have supported about $88 billion of toll revenue financings, with $22 billion of that happening in just the last 5 years. And across 22 studies they conducted for startup toll roads like the Kinnick Arm Crossing, actual traffic has averaged 96% of the base forecast, so they've been very close, and almost all of the projects have been within plus or minus 25%. With this particular bridge, we are estimating that 67% or better of traffic will meet the obligations over the term of the contract. So there's significant coverage ratio. In February of this year, Wilbur Smith updated their 2007 numbers to reflect a more negative economy that we've all been experiencing for the last couple of years, and a more conservative population forecast, and those figures are reflected in our financial models. The authority is very confident in the independent traffic and toll revenue forecast and the project's ability to meet its obligations, which are primarily that annual payment to the private partner. Over the life cycle of the Kinnick Arm Bridge, we'll recover the investment as well as generate returns that could either result in lower tolls in the future or additional infrastructure investment in the state. And those decisions will be made by future policymakers. In conclusion, amendments under HB 158 establish the mechanisms needed to develop a successful public-private partnership contract under the terms the marketplace expects. Because of this, HB 158 will attract the most competitive proposals at the lowest cost and best value to the state. HB 158 in and of itself does not commit the state to anything unless the private sector proposals are accepted and finalized, and acceptance is subject to a very rigorous procurement process with the final decision being made whether to accept any proposals by the board. HBA 158 demonstrates that the state is serious about the essential nature of the project and its role in the public-private agreement as project owner, and it signals that Alaska is open for business and confident in our future. Over time, the project will generate a continuing surplus toll revenue stream that can be used to fund other needed transportation improvements, or alternatively, future policymakers could reduce tolls for users of the bridge. And finally, the crossing is needed to support economic development and jobs, provide access to land for population and industrial growth, facilitate the movement of people and freight, and for safety. In my view, this project will benefit generations of Alaskans, and I urge this committee to move HB 158 on to help citizens realize those benefits as soon as possible. That concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Let's go, Representative Peterson.
Yeah, this might be for Representative Newman. It's my understanding that there was a ferry built, and there were plans to have ferry carrying vehicles and people across from Point McKenzie to Anchorage. And I'm understanding that that is running a little behind schedule right now, but significant funds were invested in this ferry. And historically, other areas have had ferry operations for a significant number of years until a population density was reached to where a bridge became more economical and necessary. For example, the Golden Gate Bridge between Oakland and San Francisco, and bridges in New York City, I'm sure numerous others. So, you know, what's going on with the ferry right now, Mark?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, to Representative Peterson. Yes, the ferry is sitting in Ketchikan right now. It was a wonderful world-class ferry, new technology. Very proud of the people in Ketchikan and the opportunities that they had to do that, funded by the United States Navy, about a $60 million boat. But it's a world-class type of boat that will not only just go between Anchorage and Matsu, but especially go down to Kenai, Homer, Tionic, and serve the whole Cook Inlet area. And it'll be used for those purposes. And so it's expected to serve the whole Kinnick area, or Kinnick Cook Inlet area, which will complement the bridge in the transport of traffic into there. So they'll work very well together to make sure that we have expedited movement of our transportation system. Thank you.
Follow-up, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are we expecting that to be starting operation soon, or is there a holdup with the Anchorage port, or is it? I know there was a problem with they could either haul people or haul cars, but they couldn't haul both. Do you have any more information on that?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, this ship can haul semis, it can haul people, it can haul vehicles, and with the new administration in Anchorage, again, we do have letters from Mayor Sullivan supporting this, and right now we're working on getting the funds in the capital budget to get the docks put in at Point McKenzie and in towards the Anchorage area. And I want to mention too that, you know, how they, because you brought the subject up, how these will complement each other with the ports, with Anchorage being a container port, Point McKenzie being an industrial port, and the ability to move freight and traffic between potentially, well, obviously, the most important port that we've got in Alaska right now with Anchorage, the largest port, diversifying our economy, and have an industrial port next door right across the inlet, and the ability to move back and forth on the bridge.
Representative Newman, so it can take well, because there's no dock, we have to wait for the money to get the docks fixed now or built now. But right, am I correct in saying that?
Through the chair, yes, Madam Madam Chair. Right now, there is proposed funding. So there's some federal funding, state funding, match fundings to get in the docks. Now it's been a process that's been ongoing, just like most projects are.
Sure. Is it, but I didn't hear you say yes, we can do both in both directions when after the docks are in.
Oh, absolutely, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The on page 2 of the bill, line 17. I'm worried about the amount of risk that the state would be taking on, specifically because of this amendment to it. How much risk is going to be, or how much of an obligation is going to be incurred by the authority that the state is, by this, taking the risk to potentially have to be obligated to pay back?
Yes, Kevin?
Either one of you guys.
I'm through the chair. I just wasn't sure if you're looking for actual, trying to get a sense of numbers, or it's Andrew Nemec. I'm sorry, Andrew Nemec.
Okay.
Kubota.
No, since you don't know how much it's going to cost, but if the obligations incurred by the authority under the partnerships or contracts. The cost of building the bridge is is part of that, correct?
Through the chair. Yes, it is. The what it's doing is clarifying that a contract with the authority for the purposes of constructing the crossing is basically the private industry would be doing business with the state of Alaska. It's clarifying that. As far as specifically the it's under this agreement, are the state of Alaska, Kabod and the state of Alaska, responsible for the payment to the private developer? The private developer will be procuring the construction contract. And so normally the state of Alaska would be contracting directly with the private sector for constructing a facility and paying the contractor for that. Normally the owners takes on the construction risk. The contractor has some, but the state does. In this case, the private developer, that's their design build contract or contracts. And those contracts are not state of Alaska contracts. Our state of Alaska responsibilities that I believe you're getting to or questioning are our payments. When we get proposals back from the developers, those are, and we accept them, then that is our responsibility. That is our exposure.
And yes. Follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Feige.
So to make this clear in my mind and perhaps minds of the rest of the committee members, the private entity will have the bonding authority to go out and raise funds for the actual construction of the bridge. And they will be obligated to pay back those bonds. The state has an agreement with the private company to operate the bridge, and that's what we're obligated to.
Through the chair to Representative Feige, this is Kevin Hemingway. The structure is that the private sector is responsible for design, build, finance, operation, and maintenance. The contracts that they have for design, build will be between them and their constructors. Okay. The contract that they have with their lenders, whether it's TIFIA or the private activity bond holders, or it could be a bank credit facility, will be between them and their lenders on a non-recourse basis to the state. Whether they directly do the operations and maintenance or subcontract the operations and maintenance, their responsibilities under those contracts will be theirs. And their responsibility to the state is to build the infrastructure on our behalf and maintain it to a quality standard over the term of the agreement and hand it back to us in a certain state at the end of the agreement in exchange for the annual payment. So the state's risk will be known when those proposals are received, and the state's primary source for meeting those obligations, which is that annual payment, is the toll revenue. Okay, so to be clear, all of the focus from a financial perspective for this project really should be on what are the proposals that we're going to receive and will the toll revenue be sufficient. We've modeled that on a pro forma basis, which means as if we were standing in the shoes of the developer with very good information on cost estimates, operations and maintenance costs, toll collections, etc. But those will actually be contracts of the private partner with whoever they're contracting with, and the contract the state will be entering into if it gets through the evaluation process, is responsive, and is acceptable, would be to commit to making those annual availability payments, and they're maximum, because if they underperform, there's reductions to the payment up to the point of potentially losing the agreement. We will not have any obligation related to the debt or to their design build contract, which are the primary cost elements in the entire project.
Okay, thank you.
I'm very confused, because it does say if we follow through, it says that the authority may 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Number 5 says, make and execute agreements, contracts with all the others for the purpose of, and then it's got A and B, entering into public-private partnerships or service contracts in any form. And then it says, and this has been added, and this doesn't seem to me that it says what you just said. And so that's the confusing part here. It says the monetary obligations incurred by the authority under the partnerships or contracts are obligations of the state. And so it doesn't appear to me that that's what you just said.
Madam Chair, to clarify, the primary contractual obligation of the state will be to make that annual payment. Like a lot of contracts, there's other components that will have things like, in the event of early termination, which will have a clause that will permit that, that we will compensate them to make them whole and things like that. But presuming that we move forward with the contract, the primary obligation will be to make the annual availability payment or the annual lease payment or whatever you want to use for terminology under that agreement. So that's the primary contractual obligation. And I think we've all seen contracts where the lawyers think of everything that might happen. But the fact is that that is the real state obligation under the contract.
Okay, so...
And we will just, pardon me, we will not know what that offer is until we receive proposals. The models we've run are called pro forma, and there's as if we're standing in their shoes, so we have a very good idea what those proposals will look like.
So this is true, then, that the monetary obligations incurred by the authority under the partnership or contracts are the obligations of the state. So that says that what the obligations that you have, if you have a partnership with the state, will now be the obligation of the state. Is that true?
Madam Chair, yes, that is true, because the state is the owner of the bridge, and the private sector will expect to know that the state will meet its obligations.
Okay. So what you're saying then with this bill is that you as the authority will make all kinds of agreements with all kinds of other people, but once you make an agreement with the state's ultimately responsible.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Andrew Nemec, I think that maybe simply put, it would be when we are the state of Alaska. I mean, the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is a state public corporation. It is clarifying. It's already believed when people are doing business with Kubota, they're doing business with the state of Alaska. But we were advised that it would be more correct to have it better defined, and so that is what it's doing. It's basically saying it's one and the same. It is the state of Alaska entering into that agreement. It's clarifying it, and so I don't know if there's a more simple way to say it.
Okay.
I may think of it, but it is the state of Alaska entering into this agreement. It is a state of Alaska facility, state of Alaska contract.
Okay, and I can see that Representative Newman wants to say something here. And so essentially, because the state of Alaska asked you as an authority to figure all this out, and you figured all this out, but when anybody, all along when you've said a private partnership, private-public partnership, what you meant public is the state of Alaska, and private is anybody else. Is that correct? Okay.
Yes.
Representative Newman.
Representative Newman. Yes, Madam Chair, you're correct. And just trying to, maybe because I'm not an attorney or a CPA or something, I'm trying to bring it back down to a little closer level to at least where I can understand, is Kubota is an entity of the state. Just as the railroad is an entity of the state, Alaska Housing, ADA. They're an entity of the state. So as when they say it's the state's liabilities, Kubota is that entity of the state that represents that. But when we look at cost overruns, because this is going to be a public-private partnership, and that private part will do the contracting out. If there's cost overruns, that's their problem. It's not the state's problem. When this deal comes back to the state or to be approved by Kubota Board of Directors, the State Attorney General's Office, and Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, we'll have to approve this plan and any financing on this. And once that's done, that's the state's position, or the Kabata is part of that. But cost overruns, that's their problem. That's the private's, you know, because they're going to do the contract and the construction and stuff. So it takes us off the hooks on obligations of overruns and such. But I think the question is the state, Kabata is the state under this, and it just makes sure that it states that.
And I see that there's someone in the back that wants to make some comments. And you will, right now, we're still having discussions, and you will be able to testify. Today, our meeting isn't going to be over until 3:30. So, we start at 1:30. All right.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I ask some questions?
You sure can. Question? Representative Johnson.
Who's asking for the clarification? You said this. It was asked that it be clarified, that we stipulate this in clarification. Who's asking for the clarification? Financers, Kabata Board, State of Alaska, Attorney General. Who? Where's this coming from? Who's driving this?
Through the chair. Our advisors are at this point. We are not. We have not put an RFP on the street, or this is not coming from the from industry at this time. And I don't have an official opinion from the Attorney General. I mean, it's based on we have advisors that are actually hired by, they're on contract to the Department of Law, and yet we want to make sure that when we have a contract, an agreement put together, that there is no weakness in it, and we don't want that to be reflected in proposals that come back to the state where there's some built-in costs that we would wind up, I mean, we'd get higher proposals back basically from the private sector. So we've been advised that these are areas of clarification. The property tax is a similar case.
I understand the property tax. Okay. That makes perfect sense.
So it is our advisors that are making these recommendations at this point.
And one more question.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
What's the annual payment on your pro forma?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, this is Kevin Hemingway. The annual payments that we're modeling right now, and again, they're pro forma, which means we're as if we're standing in the shoe, so we're what's what we expect to see, would be approximately $32 million at opening. The way that availability payments are structured is they typically increase over time as traffic grows to take into account the maintenance. So we've modeled that that's growing at about 4% for the first 15 or 20 years. And as traffic levels out, that increases only by about the rate of inflation. But by the time you get to the end of the agreement, if you'll give me just a moment to look it up, the final payments will be on the order of about $140 million. Now, we believe we've modeled these conservatively, and they could be significantly lower. And just for a comparison, the revenue forecast for the same year is on the order of $285 million. So that's a coverage ratio of 2 times.
Okay, follow-up, Representative Johnson.
And what's your assumption of the toll to be able to cover that?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, this is Kevin Hemingway again. The toll that we have modeled is $5 at opening for a passenger vehicle. It is higher depending on the number of axles, but averages about $18 per crossing for commercial vehicles. And then it is modeled to be in constant dollars, which really means that in nominal dollars, that will grow at about the rate of inflation with an annual increase that we've modeled at approximately 2.5%, which is a little bit lower than Anchorage Consumer Price Index over the last 10 years.
Thank you, ma'am.
I have a question for with that. Most people's income doesn't increase at that rate. And so is it realistic to think that you can charge, add that charge on? So if, you know, first of all, I'm thinking of me as a person driving over the bridge. But if I do it every day, that's $10 a day. And then if next year, I don't know what that would be with the consumer price index, but maybe that would be $13 a day or $13 a day or something. But if it's going to go up every single year, but my income doesn't go up every single year, then is that realistic to think that people are going to do that? I suppose if the price of gas keeps going up, maybe they would. I don't know. How much at current prices right now are you thinking that people are going to save by going around that way instead of the other way?
Madam Chair, this is Kevin Hemingway. We used Wilbur Smith to model this traffic and revenue forecast, and they're the preeminent toll modelers around the country. And the thinking that goes into all of those equations really goes into their traffic and revenue models. But I think I can make it a little simpler for all of us to understand and take my financing hat off for just a moment and point out that the average home, new single-family home in the Mat-Su is $189,000 less than the average new single-family home in Anchorage because Anchorage is out of land. The average single-family home, including resale, in the Mat-Su is $140,000 less than the average single-family home in Anchorage. Today, the population growth that's coming is being forced to move 50 miles up the road to the Palmer-Wasilla area, and with the bridge, they'll be able to live 10 miles from downtown Anchorage. If gas rises to $5 or $6 or $7, as some are predicting, the more I can cut out of that trip, the better off I'm going to be. Traffic's going to be fairly low in the opening years. We're looking at about 3,000, a little over 3,000 round trips a day, 6,000 crossings. But that grows over time. So a lot of the projection is based on where future population growth goes. And with the bridge in place, and I look at that housing price differential, at the same time wages in Anchorage average about 36% higher than the Matanuska-Sioux-Sitna borough. The most economic way to live in South Central today is to work in Anchorage and to live in the valley. But to do that, I have to drive 60 miles. If I can do that and drive 10 miles, that's a much better transaction for me as a consumer in the public. To try to give you some idea of what happens, at 2.5% inflation, my $5 toll today is $5.10 next year. And then it's the year after that, it's something like $5.22. And I'm sure that things will probably be actually rounded to the nickel. And for $10 a day for a $140,000 less expensive home and driving 30 miles less than I would have to each way if I lived up in Palmer or Wasilla, I think it's a great value for consumers.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You talked about prices of homes and home values. I was wondering if anyone has done a study on how this would affect the average home prices in Anchorage, and if it did have a negative effect on home values, that would also have a negative effect on property tax collections for the municipality of Anchorage. And I was wondering if you've done any studies on that and what effects that might have on current economics in the city of Anchorage.
Through the chair to Representative Peterson, the socioeconomic studies that were done for the bridge indicate that Anchorage tax increment is about break even with or without the bridge. And that's looking out 23 years after opening. While tax increment in the Mat-Su goes up by about $1.2 billion during that same time frame to pay for infrastructure needs that will come to support that growing population. I'm not a realtor, and the scope of the authority is more limited, so I'll just give you some anecdotal comments that we've seen in the industry or out in the street from real estate experts. One of them is Chris Stevens of Bond Stevens & Johnson. He sees no impact on Anchorage home values, but he does see the homes in the Mat-Su borough that would be constructed closer to Anchorage being higher valued than the ones further from Anchorage because of their proximity to those high jobs.
Follow up?
Follow up, Representative Peterson.
Thank you. With the current population in the valley, that it would be located close enough to Anchorage to make it, you're talking about a 10-minute drive. Right now, there are very few people that are living in that area to where it would be a 10-minute drive to Anchorage across the bridge. So how long is it going to take to build up a bedroom community large enough to make that 10-minute drive into Anchorage? I mean, I know real estate development will happen, but it's gonna take some while, and there's gonna be some growing pains because they're also gonna have to develop schools, hospitals, water, wastewater, and that type of infrastructure if a new city is gonna be built across the inlet. And so that would be very taxing on the infrastructure costs for the Matsu Borough.
Representative Newman.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, I think it's somewhat the inverse of what you're thinking, what Kevin was just saying. Property value, tax evaluations in Anchorage would probably remain neutral. The value of a house in Matsu would go up closer because you're closer to the largest industrial center, Anchorage. In Big Lake, where I live, it would put me about 25 miles from Anchorage. It's 65 miles to drive around the other way. So that's a considerable amount. And again, what options do we have? We've got 230, you know, we're 250% above capacity on the people. 30,000 people a day commute that. So, yeah, there is the traffic there. There is the capacity to cover those right now, you know, I believe. And, again, you talked about the expense of the Matsu Borough, but the property value of the houses will increase, too, to help cover those costs without a negative impact on Anchorage.
I think I'm finally getting my thought processes. This is very much like the ferry system, because you have to build the ferry. It's going to cost a lot, and over the years you're hoping that you get enough in sometime to work it out. But no matter what kind of infrastructure you build, it's never going to pay for itself, probably. But because we're going to put a toll on this one, we might be able to do it. So I can understand. We're constantly fighting for money to build another ferry. This is money to build a bridge. So I can see where we're coming from here. And at first, I was thinking a private personal project was, or private public was out in the public, not the state. And so now I'm realizing that it is the state with private partnership here. So that I guess I didn't really realize that to begin with. So, I would like to hear from the department first, and then we'll get back. But
question from
okay, both
quickly,
Representative Johnson.
Who owns the land on the other end of the bridge? What's the mix of private, state ownership at the other end?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, Kevin Hemingway again. There, in the area that our traffic and revenue studies indicate will be impacted, there's approximately 3,000 private landowners. Some own more significant parcels, some own small parcels. The state of Alaska owns some of the land. The native corporations own some of the land, and the borough owns a significant amount of land in that area. So there's a tremendous number of landowners.
Matsu Borough?
Matsu Borough, yeah. So it's just a real mix. There's no single largest landowner.
Again, through the chair, to Representative Johnson, I think the largest landowner is probably the borough. The university owns several thousand acres in the area, and the state of Alaska, then probably Siri, and from there it goes down through private landowners that own between several hundred acres to partial acres.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you.
Representative Newman.
Just on that point, Representative Johnson, The larger parcel owners there are the farmers out there. And the way our statutes currently read now, those farmers can't take and subdivide that into one-acre lots and do that because it's zoned agricultural land. So it has to stay in agricultural land the way our statutes are. So it's not like somebody can become an instant millionaire because they can develop a subdivision there. And by the way, Madam Chair, the unique part of this, I think we heard earlier, is this will actually be paying revenues back to the general fund.
Yeah, that's what
I said. Positive effect.
Yeah. The toll, because the toll.
And coverage costs.
Yeah. Representative Munoz.
So thank you. That gets to my question. Just so I generally understand, there here is proposed $500 or $600 million in state bonding authority, which would roughly match the private bonding authority. Is that correct? And it's roughly a 35-year payoff. No? Yes. Okay.
through the chair, Representative Munoz. This is Kevin Hemingway. The bonding authority that we are requesting in HB 158 is to permit the private partner to fully utilize the $600 million of a national allocation to this project from the U.S. Department of Transportation. And under the last transportation authorization, Safety Lou, there was a $15 billion national cap. Alaska received $600 million of that for this project. And private activity bonds under the IRS code, tax code, require that they be issued by a public entity, but the public entity is not the borrower, the private entity is. So we're looking to up our bonding capacity so that the private partner can fully utilize the $600 million of tax-exempt financing if they determine that that's the optimal proposal, the optimal financial plan that they can come up with in proposing that annual availability payment. Financing is probably the single biggest part. It's probably a more expensive piece over the life of the project than the construction cost. And so what we're trying to do is to get us or another public issuer in the state to be able to do on a conduit issuance basis to issue that debt for the private partner as the borrower. The 35 years for after substantial completion that we've talked about is because that matches the type of long-term financing that the private partner needs to build this kind of infrastructure and operate and maintain it to make it an attractive contract for them. But from the state's perspective, we are not the borrower of that debt.
Okay, and then one follow-up. And who is the private partner?
Through the chair to Representative Munoz, the private partner will be selected through a procurement process. Right now we have shortlisted two entities, and what they normally do is establish something called a special purpose vehicle. Basically it's an LLC or LLP, and the equity, they bring in the equity money, they borrow the funds from the lenders, which could be bonds or TIFIA or any or bank credit. They will hire the design builder who will be involved with the project only during the construction period and possibly some short warranty period depending on their contract. And they either operate and maintain it themselves or subcontract that as well. And they do that over the term of the agreement, and our obligation under the contract is to make an annual payment for them to build the infrastructure for us and to operate and maintain it to a quality standard over the term of the agreement. We're not the borrowers of the debt. We're not the parties in the design-build contract or anything else. What we really are doing is simply establishing the contract standards they need to operate and maintain at through the public-private agreement. And what happens behind that is left to them as long as they meet our performance standards.
Follow-up, Representative.
And then when the tolls start bringing in significantly more than what the bond payments are, where do those profits go? Where do the profits go?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, the excess toll revenue would first go to replenish, if used, any of the reserve fund. The HB 158 provides the ability to establish the reserve fund. Not being heard here is HB 159, which would fund it. First. Second, it would go to capacity improvements on the project to meet traffic growth. Third, it would go to other eligible transportation projects within the state. This is a federal highway project, so it's subject to what is known as a Section 129 tolling agreement, which simply says that if you have any surplus toll revenues after repaying project financing and maintaining it, et cetera, that the only requirement is that it be reinvested in eligible transportation projects as they're defined under the federal statute. So it could be roads, bridges, ferries, bike paths, et cetera.
Your transportation fund.
There you go. So then the state would never be obligated to pay back any of the bonds, no matter what.
Representative Wilson, Chair, this is Kevin Hemingway. That is correct. If there was, for example, the Chapter 11 bankruptcy of the private partner, their debt, their lenders, their creditors would work it out with them through normal Chapter 11 procedures without recourse to the state.
Okay, so but it says that the monetary obligations incurred by the authority, which is the state. Okay, so you're the state. So the monetary obligations incurred by the state under the partnership or contract are obligations of the state. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yes. So we are if they don't pay it, then we are obligated to pay it.
Chair Wilson, that's not correct. What we are obligated to pay, as long as they are performing to the performance standards of making the road available, we're obligated to pay the annual payment to the private partner. What happens between them and their lenders is between them and their lenders. We're not the borrowers.
Okay, so if we have to pay then, which is the same thing, we have to pay them, they're supposed to pay then the bonds. So if they can't pay them, I mean, they're going to pay them because we're going to be paying them.
No. Chair Wilson, we will only pay them if they meet the performance requirements of the contract between the state and the private partner. If that's not enough for them to pay the bonds, that's a different issue that is not recourse to us. But as long as they are meeting the requirements for the road to be available and the level of maintenance, they earn the annual payment. There's a very clear contractual distinction there.
Okay. Can someone explain it to me so I understand it?
Want to take a brief at ease?
Yes, brief at ease. Explain it to me. Okay. We do have a gentleman that came from out of town, and he won't be able to testify next time, so I'm going to take your testimony. And if you can come forward and state your name and affiliation, we will be glad to hear your testimony.
My name is Jamie Kenworthy. I used to operate a state agency. I'm a finance type. I'd like to start out. I'm a financial analyst,
okay.
Finance investor type. I'd like to start off through the chair answering Representative Fagy's question,
right,
which is, what is the liability to the state? In the pro forma statement you see in front of you, based upon their estimate of 10 days ago, that obligation is $3.2 billion. In other words, they would sign a contract with the winning private partner, their current estimate of what that would be. And these bills would guarantee that contract. That's what the language in HB 158, 159 say, that the obligations of Kibada are obligations of the state. The second question that Representative Johnson asked through the chair was, who wants this clarification? I have a different answer. The people who are bidding on this project want this qualification, because under Kibada's original statute, they could not issue debt or have liabilities that were obligations of the state. They were like ADA. They could issue bonds, and they would have moral authority of the state, but they were basically only the responsibility of the agency. They were not, like general obligation bonds, direct obligations of the state. That's why I came to Juneau to testify, because the estimates of the total revenue shortfall on this are huge. They have used population numbers that are 50% higher than ICER and 64% higher than the state demographer. So once they sign a contract, those become your obligations because you have changed the rules of the game. The game was, and this was the Dittman poll of 3 years ago, if the private sector pays for 70-90% of this deal, if the private sector takes the risk, that's why the Anchorage Assembly approved this, based upon no further state funds. AMATS had the same decision. This changes everything. And you don't know the cost of that change. You have Kubota's current estimate on this. Let me roll out what would happen in a bankruptcy, because it happened last year in San Diego. Macquarie, one of the two bidders on the project, created a subsidiary called, you know, Macquarie San Diego, just like there'd be Macquarie McKinnick Bridge. Because the toll revenue was too low to pay the bonds, they defaulted. Okay, and the subsidiary, of course, had no resources. There was an LLC. They had no recourse to Macquarie, this huge financial institution in Australia. Now, let's say I buy the bonds, not of the state, but Mr. Hemingway's correct. I buy the bonds of the private partner. Let's call it Macquarie Connect Bridge or Macquarie Bouget, the French firm. And they stop making payments. They stop making payments either because they get into a dispute with Kubota, because one day the legislature doesn't want to give them $100 million. That's just not a number pulled out of the hat. There's a year there where we first hit $100 million. And the state has other priorities, and there's too little shortfall to cover that. The state decides not to give them. So I sue the private partner. But the first thing my attorney is going to do is to go after the deep pockets. They're going to go after the state of Alaska. They're going to try to get Alaska in that bankruptcy case. And they'll have good cause. The first Exhibit A of that will be these bills, because these bills say obligations of Kubota. This is the availability payment structure of $3.2 billion over 35 years. You see in these pro forma. I came here to walk you through those pro formas. By the way, last year when Kubota submitted a similar application on March 1st, 2010, they estimated the availability payment not to be 3.2 of this year, but to be 6.3 billion. Now, since then, a couple changes. They've got the $150 million in here that appropriates from the general fund, so that leads to a lower number because you don't have to pay the interest on that. And secondly, they've lowered the return of 14% a year to 12%. But there's still a huge amount there I can't understand. But it concerns me that last year their estimate of the contract they would sign with a private partner was $3 billion more than this year's estimate of what they would sign with a private contract. And it is not a trivial issue that someone we have contracts with would default on an obligation to debtors, even if we came out of that bankruptcy process still owning the asset of the bridge, because that's the other thing creditors would go after. They'd go after the bridge. It concerns me because if you have a state agency, and you're right, Madam Chair, that is an obligation. So if you have a state agency that defaults on an obligation, whether you call that a bond or a contract for $3.2 billion, the credit markets are going to notice that. The first things Moody's and S&P are going to do is they're going to put the state of Alaska under review for possible downgrade. So if you're running HFC or the municipal bond bank and you have a municipality that wants to, you know, upgrade their dock and they want to put their bond issue through the municipal bond bank, or if you have HFC or if you have ADA and there's another red dog deal that comes along and you want to do the financing at a reasonable cost to get the deal done, all of a sudden you could be paying higher interest rates, because if one state agency is defaulting on its obligations, who's to say creditors are going to look at that? And I own state of Alaska bonds. I own HFC bonds. They're going to look at that and say, well, these bonds were just technically the moral obligation of the state. That's what, when ADA issues bonds, that when HFC and the municipal bond banks, that's what they say on a cover sheet. They're not direct obligations of the state. But investors understand that there's a moral obligation, if not a legal obligation. And if you have agencies default on contracts of this size or bond issues, it's going to have an impact on the credit ratings that all our agencies pay. And I don't think we have a new AAA credit rating. I'd like to keep it. It's going to lower borrowing costs over the years. So you have to care about the numbers in the pro forma sheet. I don't know if you're going to give me the time in 3 minutes to go over the pro forma sheet, but I've got some red flags for the committee.
Proceed.
The first red flag is, look at page 4 of your document. Before, look at page 1, sources and uses. Okay, you see the $150 million that's in? That has been described to you as a reserve fund.
Where on page 4?
It says right on the right under state, on the right-hand side.
On the first page?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sources and uses of funds. It says $150 million. That is not a reserve fund in any meaning of the word that's standard for financial people. They are directly committing that $150 million to the project from day one.
Okay, you're not talking about the bill?
No, I'm talking about the pro forma.
Okay.
Okay.
That pro forma sheet.
Okay.
This one right here, Madam Chair.
All right.
That says on the last column, next last column, it says public investment, state grant. Okay. That's the $150 million in this bill. Okay? So I wouldn't describe that as a reserve fund if it's going right into the deal.
Well,
I see where
it says state grant, but
the way across it says $150 million.
Okay.
Here's the second thing I want the committee to pick up on, and that is you see on upper left-hand corner, second line down, it says capital accretion bonds, $40,792,000. Okay, look at the
cover.
Oh,
yes, yes.
Okay?
Yes.
Well, if you look at page 5 of this document, capital accretion bonds are a fancy way of saying we can't afford the interest in the early years. We're going to add it to the principal, and you'll be paying interest on interest. Okay? So the question would be, how good is this deal? When can they pay off those capital accretion bonds? And the answer on the second column of page 5 is, you are going to pay $248 million to pay off $41 million of principal. So you'll have $41 million of principal and over $200 million in interest.
At the latter stages.
Yeah. I mean, when you mortgage $300,000 on your house.
Is that what
and
the
bank
up to?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and
and that's a red flag. Because when you go to a bank and mortgage your house for $300,000, they give you a statement saying, oh, by the life of this 30-year, 15-year mortgage, you're going to pay $420,000 or $450,000. They don't say, when you pay the life of this loan of $300,000, you're going to pay $1.2 million. It's not a factor of four. That's what this deal shows. That's the second red flag.
Okay, what was the total
at the top of that column, it says tax-exempt capital appreciation bonds, annual debt service. $248,427,000.
Okay.
Well, on the front page, you see capital accretion bonds, $40.7 million going in. But by the time you pay all the interest, because you can't afford the interest in the early years, you're paying a huge amount. You're paying basically six times the original thing. Okay, that's the second red flag I would like to
I want to write this down.
In financial markets, we call that negative amortization or negative equity. The reason I'm here is because this has eerie similarities to what caused the housing crisis. You have low down payments, can't afford the early payments. You have negative amortization. In other words, you owe more in year two. Most mortgages, you know, you owe less in year two. This deal, you're going to owe more, significantly more, because you don't have the total revenue to to make your availability payments. In fact, you can see from the these are Kubota's numbers of 10 days ago, that they had $16 million in toll revenue the first year of 2016, but they have $38 million in availability payments. Well, how are you going to make that make that up? The answer is you're going to put it out farther years. You're going to increase your equity. The third thing I'd like you to notice on page six is the amount of availability payments. And that amount is $3.2 billion. So that's my answer, Representative Fahey, to what's the liability you're getting into with these bills, based upon Kubota's current estimates. Kubota will sign a contract committing itself to those $3.2 billion. The private partner will then take that contract and be able to show a rating agency, hey, I've made a deal with the state of Alaska. So I'm going to get these payments subject to annual appropriation, they say. And that's what's going to give this private partner, which in San Diego that went bankrupt, or the Grenville tollway that also went bankrupt last year, that they have no other assets, basically. Their asset is the contract with the state of Alaska. And what's going to happen is that there's just too little revenue in the early years to make the toll payments. That's why these numbers are so bad. So another warning sign you see is what's called balloon payments. When you have your mortgage, you pay a fixed amount, and as the mortgage goes on every year, it's more and more principal and less interest. Most of the successful private partnership deals that have been done by states, they have a fixed amount. It's like your mortgage. It's a fixed amount. These are balloon amounts. And by the way, they didn't get the TIFIA loan last year, and my fearless forecast is they won't get it this year because other deals are better, that whose numbers are better, and those other deals, when you have interstate highways fall, you know, bridges falling down, they have real existing congestion. They have real population numbers. If you see the cost numbers of this deal on page three, my simple message to you is believe those cost numbers. The availability payment, the O&M cost, the tolling operations, the sinking fund for capital expenditures, believe the cost numbers. I came to Juneau to tell you do not believe the revenue numbers. And the reason I'm telling you not to believe the revenue numbers is that in 2007, when ICER said there'll be 204,000 people in the valley in 2030, they didn't take that number. They went to Texas, hired an InSearch research company. And Kubota will tell you it's a reputable, well-known firm. I'm here to tell you they shopped the numbers so the financials would look better. And the test of that is that ICER's current number for 2030 is 169,000. And in December, the state demographer, Elizabeth Mercer, came out with a new new population number for the valley of 156,000. And that was in 2034. So she had Kubota's number was 64% higher than the state demographer. And the state demographer had her number out 4 more years. In other words, gave it 4 more years to grow. Now, right now, there's an interesting battle going on, and the chair could play a great role in it, because the Department of Transportation has a traffic model for how many trips are on the Glen Highway and the bridge, if it's built, for the year 2030. They refused to release those numbers. We've been told they don't have them. We've been told they have them, but they're too variable or too low, and we've been told to go to Kubota to get them. So this week, yesterday or today, we filed a public information request because we're being stiff for the numbers. Those numbers would be very helpful because since you have to do the due diligence on this deal because you're guaranteeing the contract, you want to know, is Kubota right? Will there be a quarter million people in the valley in 20 years? There's 89,000, well, the census came out today. Mr. Hemingway is right. There's 91,000 in the valley today. But if there's 150,000 in the valley in 20 years, the toll revenue numbers really slide off. In other words, that availability, they're counting on the tolls to pay off the availability payment. But the toll, because the population numbers are off, I think the toll revenue numbers are off by 50%. And when you start talking about $3.2 billion, I think you're talking about real money.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What you're saying, I understand. Those, and I have some of those concerns as well regarding the population numbers. For purposes so we know kind of where you're coming from, could you describe a little bit about your background?
I was the executive director of the Alaska Science and Technology Foundation for 7.5 years. But I mainly worked on early stage risk capital businesses that were technology based, and I did a similar job in Michigan. So I have a background in, you know, I don't have a financial credential, but I have basically been putting together finance deals and reading business plans for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that when I retired, I saw the housing bust coming. I saw the housing bust coming, and I've never made more money not working than I did working very hard. And the symptoms of balloon payments, overestimated, and undocumented income. Mm-hmm. And negative amortization, where you owe more tomorrow than you owe today. It was all there. It was right in front of everybody watching the housing market in 2008. And Don Jamie Kenworthy in Anchorage, Alaska saw it and shorted Bear Stearns at 150 and Lehman at 40. And I put a third of it in the Community Foundation. I haven't upped my lifestyle that much. That's why I'm here. I'm a citizen who's looked at this deal, who's taken it around to three bond geek friends who also don't think this makes sense. But they still do some business with the state of Alaska, so you need someone who has no financial interest in this at all. I have no financial. I'm a volunteer. I live in South Anchorage. It's going to compromise the Government Hill neighborhood that I work with. But
you live there?
No, I live in South Anchorage. This won't affect my neighborhood. It won't affect my income. I'm not getting any money from this deal. I think that I'm just trying to prevent the state from making a billion-dollar mistake.
Fair enough.
Okay. Any other questions?
No, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, you said that their numbers were 50% higher than ICER and 64% higher than the state demographer?
Yes. The state demographer has in the trends issue from the Department of Labor, her current number for 2034 is 152,000. I think it's 436. And that's 4 years out, 4 years more than the 2030 number. Now, there's been a slight adjustment to the Wilbur Smith numbers. And Mr. Hemingway and I have a friendly bet because neither knows who's right. But if you read the Wilbur Smith study on their website, there is a very strong non-warranty. Usually there's a boilerplate, and financial firms say, don't hold us responsible for this. But it's even stronger than usual. So that says basically do not count on these population estimates because it was a rush job to redo the numbers because people like us have been raising this issue at AMATs and public hearings. How can this number be so high compared to that? And in a grudging way, they know they had to redo the numbers because we're gonna tell D.C. about it just like we're telling you about it. You can't have financial information based upon overly optimistic assumptions. Mm-hmm. Been there, done that. Oh, the last warning flag that is flashing triple red for me, unlimited government guarantee. You have an unlimited government, that's what HB 158, you've captured it precisely. It says obligations of Kibata will be obligations of the state. That is not language that ADA has in its statute. That's not language Fauci at HSC has. They issue paper under their own credibility. And I think there'll be heartburn the day these deals go south if you're trying to run those agencies and you're counting on basically the good credit of the state and its agencies. So there are real consequences. And you can talk to bankruptcy lawyers. I'm not one. But when the creditors go after the state of Alaska because of these bills and things go south, as they did in San Diego this year in the second year of operation, there'll be an entire floor of the Attorney General's office that will be concerned about this, not just because of the money at stake, but because of the bad precedent if you pierce the veil of the state. And I think a good bankruptcy lawyer would tell you, eh, we'll probably win this, but the downside risks are so high to having that veil pierced that they'll be settling. So what you'll have basically is the finance committees will be briefed and they'll be told, well, we're all going to have to take a care cut on this. The creditors won't get their money right away. We'll stretch out the payments. The Macquarie Central that didn't put any assets into the local sub, you're going to have to chip in some money because your things. And the state of Alaska, whether you like it or not, no matter how bad the availability payments are or what your budget situation is in 20 years, you're going to have to keep making those payments. Everyone, this happens every day. You can just pick up the Wall Street Journal and look at the word restructuring, and that's going to be the expected scenario I'm predicting for you.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it. And it is 3:30, and I am not going to stop, or I'm not going to close public testimony, but when we come up with this bill the next time, I'm hoping you guys can respond in whatever way, both to the department and Kubota. So we appreciate everyone taking the extra time today. We started a half hour late, and we are ending half hour over. So I am closing session, and it is 3:33. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for hearing.